Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our call this afternoon. My name is Paul Cahill. I'm the Managing Director of Sales for Virtus Investment Partners. And it's always a pleasure to be joined by my friend and colleague, Joe Terranova, Virtus' Chief Market Strategist. And I'm sure many of you are more familiar with him from his role as a frequent contributor on CNBC's Halftime Program, occasional appearances on Squawk Box as well. And Joe, thanks for taking the time to join us, of course. It's great getting a chance to speak with you, as always. No shortage of topics to discuss. Let's dive right in. We're still dealing with massive health concerns in this country, which have now really morphed into economic concerns as we've gradually reopened the states and the economy. How would you describe for us the economic recovery this far? We've seen everybody has a letter. We've heard all about this throughout the March-April period and continues today. How would you describe that economic recovery? Is it a V, a U, a W, a K? My personal favorite's the Nike swoosh. Which one, how would you describe it, though, Joe?
Well, there are many letters in the alphabet. We'll break down the relevant ones here in just one second. But, Paul, let me begin by thanking everyone who has taken time out of their busy schedule this afternoon to join us on this quarterly call. I hope this call finds you, your family, and loved ones safe, well, and enjoying some quality time with each other in good health. I also encourage all of you to engage in some questions once Paul and I finish up our initial dialogue. Paul, let me tackle that question for you. As I said, there are many relevant letters in the alphabet when thinking about the capital markets and the economic conditions that currently we are faced with, both domestically and globally. There's the letter K, which comes to mind. What does the K mean? The K had its genesis in the wake of the great financial crisis. It's relevant to all of you on the call because I think what you've witnessed with the K, really in the client base, is that there are very many that have participated in the upper level of the K in the capital markets recovery, have actively participated in the growth and the emergence of a new economy here in the United States. And then unfortunately, there are many others that lost their job in the great financial crisis, never really recovered it, lost a certain income level, and because of the great financial crisis, were never really able to ascertain that previous level of income. And then there are others, as you all on this call might know, who have unfortunately found themselves in a economic and financial condition in which they're no longer even investing in the capital markets, and how sad that really is. So the K really categorizes the environment in the wake of the great financial crisis. The inequality that we are currently talking about is represented in that K. In addition to the K being a consequence of the great financial crisis, there are two other letters that are also a consequence of the great financial crisis. One is a U and the other is an L. And Paul, they're very highly correlated and they're very important to all of us on this call that are in investing. And the reason why they are so incredibly important is because the U represents inflation. And the L represents monetary policy. You see, the L will continue to remain in place until we're able to make the turn and complete the U as it relates to inflation. Inflation is missing on an annualized basis. The 10-year annualized rate of inflation falls 54 basis points below the 2% target for the Federal Reserve. So in the absence of inflation, monetary policy and that L continues to be needed and dictates to all investors because of the $90 trillion worth of global liquidity that there's a need to be invested. The letter W is very relevant when I think about the emerging markets and I think about CapEx. And we'll talk a little bit further about this, but in the phases of the economic recovery in 2020, the third phase and the phase that is in front of us now is CapEx itself. Is there the confidence on the part of corporations and their management to go out and begin to spend on non-fixed residential investments? That is going to be so critically important as the next phase in what we're witnessing in 2020. The emerging markets, we'll pick up on that in a little bit, but I think we're advancing strongly to the point where we're beginning to complete the last component of that W letter. And then lastly is the V, and the V is the most obvious one. We see the V, Paul. And the V is measured in three criteria and conditions. First of all, labor. A labor recovery that found its trough in April with an unemployment rate at 14.7% and more recently recorded an unemployment rate at 7.9%. Very analogous in terms of the rapid recovery of jobs to what we experienced in 1981 and 82, when then-Chairman, Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker telegraphed to the country for societal benefit, stability and pricing, he was going to place the economy into recession. Well, we did the very same thing in Q1 of this past year because of the COVID-19 crisis of preservation. For the societal benefit of the health and wellness of the American population, we created a still society. We froze the economy, we froze demand, and we placed the economy into recession. But keep in mind, jobs returned quickly in 81 and 82. If I go back and study that period of time, we did in fact lose 2.5 million jobs during that period. But the losses were temporary, Paul. From March of 1983 to March of 1984, non-farm payrolls gained at an average of 362,000 jobs per month. That is the fastest recovery that they had experienced since World War II. And the S&P 500 was able to price that in advance and understanding the recovery was coming. From Q2 of 82 to Q2 of 83, the S&P was up 43%. So we're recovering those jobs in a V-shaped capacity. Manufacturing is the second condition that is clearly displaying a V recovery. If I go back and I study the three most recent ISM manufacturing measures here in the United States, we've got readings above 54 for three consecutive months. Paul, we have not experienced that since the first quarter of 2019. I think what people don't realize is that manufacturing was contracting in the fall of 2019. Remember, the Federal Reserve in their easy monetary policy was enacting ahead of this crisis of preservation. We were already lowering rates in the second half of 2019. We were talking about expanding the size of the balance sheet. So all we did was really accelerate those monetary policy actions. Now, we're experiencing a V-shaped recovery in manufacturing. It's represented by some of the strength of the industrial and material sector. But what's even more compelling, Paul, is it's not just domestic. It's global in its nature. So if I look at manufacturing readings and I study Europe, Europe was not an expansion from January of 2019 until most recently. Chinese manufacturing readings are coming in at their highest levels in nearly 2 years. Labor, manufacturing, V-shaped recoveries. And then lastly, growth, which as you know is 40% overall of the S&P. And we'll talk a little bit further about these growth companies and what they really mean, not just to the capital markets and to you as stewards of capital, but really to the economy itself. So a variety of letters that are relevant in the alphabet, ranging from the K to the U, the L to the W, and then certainly the V. And I think understanding all of that kind of helps us really get a clear picture of the environment which we're navigating.
Well, I think it speaks to the complexity of the environment as well, right, Joe? I mean, there just can't be one answer, one letter to place on it in a time like this, and given all of the conditions and the backdrop that you talk about. Joe, one of my favorite things that you do, every month you put out a piece on our website called Observations and Expectations. You know, and if advisors, if you're not taking advantage of this piece, it's 3 to 5 pages, typically bullet point, snackable data that Joe provides for advisors to use. And I love the piece. Your most recent one here in October, you talk about the political backdrop, right? All of the, you walk through several scenarios given the political backdrop and where we are. We're less than 2 weeks away from the presidential election. And you can't have this conversation today without talking about the potential impact of that, if any. So what do you see coming from the results? And can you walk us through those scenarios? I think that'd be helpful to the advisors listening.
I really appreciate your observation on just the complexity of the environment represented by, you know, the multiple letters that I defined for the alphabet. And I think that complexity is represented in the way that markets are pricing currently, kind of with this tempting push-pull back and forth, stimulus, no stimulus in advance of the election. And it really speaks to the complexity of the moment. But I think what's important and what we've been trying to communicate is that there's $90 trillion in global liquidity, and then there's clearly an investable asset supply-demand imbalance that is going to supersede the presidential election outcome for long-term investors. $90 trillion worth of global liquidity, and then this investable asset supply demand imbalance. And for many of you who have heard me speak in the past, you know that it's something that I believe strongly in. The evidence clearly supports my thesis, and it continues as we speak here this afternoon on October 21st to dictate the need to be invested in the capital markets in a mannerism that's very diversified and reflective of multi-assets within the portfolio, using that vehicle to kind of get to whatever the goals and outcomes for you and your family might be. But there has not been enough supply of investable assets introduced into the capital markets in the last 15 years. And unfortunately, because of the complexity that you've defined and I've kind of outlined with this variety of letters, in the last 15 years as this consequence, the availability of publicly traded companies is down over 45%. We've tried to introduce new asset classes like commodities and hedge funds. They failed, both in terms of compelling performance and strength of liquidity. And then we've got this continued rise in demand. So I want to just clearly emphasize that critical point before I kind of offer for you the variety of outcomes that you need to be thinking about as stewards of capital. As it relates to the $90 trillion worth of global liquidity, for everyone on the call, please know the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has grown 70% in 2020 to $7.1 trillion without any correlating significant inflationary pressures being present. 33% of GDP currently, and we all know 15% of U.S. GDP right now in the form of fiscal stimulus. So we've kind of got that mosaic of coordination that's supporting the V recovery clearly. Now we think forward and we think about the election. And let's go back, and as we did in this piece, we studied the various S&P 500 performances under the 13 presidents that held office since World War II. 13 of those presidents, I believe that 7 of them were Republicans, 6 of them were Democrats. But if I try to find or assign a particular S&P 5 outcome to which party was holding the Oval Office, there was insufficient evidence to offer any credible supporting investment thesis that who holds the office would point you towards a particular direction for the S&P 500. In fact, there are 4 presidents since World War II who have enjoyed triple-digit gains for the S&P 500. ranging from 118% to 210%. Of those four presidents, two are Democrats, President William Clinton and President Barack Obama. Two are Republicans, President Dwight Eisenhower and President Ronald Reagan. Each of those presidents enjoyed multiple terms in office 8 years. If I look further down the list, Paul, what I would find is a Democrat, President Truman, holding office multiple terms, 45 to 53, and enjoying an 81% return for the S&P 500. And then President George H.W. Bush with only one term in office, but he did enjoy 52% for an S&P return. So top six performing S&P 500 presidential terms, three Republicans, three Democrats. So really, where do capital markets find the greatest impact? And it's in the outcome of the collective, the House, the Senate, and the presidency itself. And there are four potential outcomes that would most dramatically impact capital markets. The first outcome is the outcome that was being communicated strongly in the month of September, and that was that there would be a contested election or a delayed result. Let me share with all of you on the call my observation is I think the market has actually priced out a potential contested election or delayed result. So therefore, yes, there is vulnerability for the market to have a knee-jerk reaction, macro reaction, temporary in its nature, dislocations, which would provide opportunities for all of us on the call to purchase assets at a lower price point. But because it's been priced out, there is that opportunity for a contested or delayed result to impact capital markets. One of the main reasonings behind that is because of the significant increase in mail-in voting and the legislation surrounding when those mail-in votes can actually be counted. So in critical presidential swing states such as Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the votes cannot be counted until Election Day. Now, unless within the last couple of hours they've reversed some of that policy to get those votes counted earlier, and I know there is initiatives in the courts to try and do that, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, critical presidential swing states, that is a very difficult task to count all of those ballots in the course of 24 hours. I want everyone to think for themselves about the Democratic presidential primary in June in Pennsylvania when it took 1 week to count all of those ballots. In addition to that, you have critical Senate elections unfolding in South Carolina, Alabama, and Mississippi. The same conditions exist. You can't count the ballots until Election Day. There are other states in which 1 week before you could begin to count: Iowa, Michigan, New Hampshire, also very critical states. But overall, it's a very difficult task to count these mail-in ballots, and that's really where the premise of a contested election or delayed result as outcome number one comes into play. In that circumstance, correlations, risk assets rise, volatility rises, there will be a knee-jerk, as I discussed today on CNBC, the potential for a correction in the capital markets, short-term in its nature, would be present, and you would reverse some of the higher pricing for Treasury yields that we've experienced here with a 17 basis point higher move for the 10-year Treasury since the beginning of October. You'd see a little pressure on yields with some safe haven Treasury buying. The second outcome would be a red wave, and that would just be really, and obviously somewhat surprising, but it would be something that would be a continuation of existing policies, and I would argue really an acceleration of the existing policies. You would get further relaxation of some of the tax structure, whether it be the payroll tax. You would certainly see a continuation of nationalism and the tariffs that accompany nationalism, which does offer a little bit of a negative margin offset for corporations. And then regulation overall, which really was a fiscal tailwind in the last 4 years under President Trump's administration, that would remain as a very strong tailwind for the capital market. you would have the possibility for some form of an infrastructure bill. I think the capital markets and the population as a whole in either a red or blue wave is seeking that type of fiscal spending. And certainly given where yields are pricing currently, I suspect that there's the financial ability to afford that opportunity to do that spending. Outcome number three would be continued gridlock. That's obviously most favorable for risk assets, one party holding the House, and then who holds the presidency, has limited impact to significantly impact legislation. Keep in mind in gridlock, and I think markets in the month of October, have, as they have begun to price out a contested election, I suspect markets are beginning to price in the potential for gridlock to exist in the formation of our government. Now, when gridlock exists in the government, what illuminates most clearly is the monetary policy climate. And that goes back to my initial comments about the $90 trillion in global liquidity. So you wake up on November 4th, and hopefully we know the results, and you've got yourself a gridlock formation. Well, I'll tell you, I'll be talking to you on CNBC and on these Virtus calls about the importance of global liquidity and how that continues to act as a nourishment for risk assets. Lastly, the fourth outcome is the blue wave. Within a blue wave, and I think, by the way, Wall Street has most communicated the impact of a blue wave. But in that blue wave, you certainly have a overall negative tax consequence, both for personal, both for corporations, and potentially for dividends and capital gains. Be careful extrapolating that negative consequence without factoring in a potential offset to that, which is the reintroduction of globalization and therefore the removal of tariffs, or certainly the lessening of currently existing tariffs. Regulatory tightening, I would offer, would be the single most longest lasting negative impact in a blue wave. But let's remember, that's micro-oriented in its nature. So regulatory environment doesn't mean correlations rise in a similar scenario to a contested election. Correlations rise and we experience a correction for the equities markets. No, a tighter regulatory environment impacts specific sectors. Clearly energy, and the way energy has been pricing recently, energy would be the most negatively impacted sector in a blue wave. Money center banks clearly would be impacted negatively as they would be forced to hoard cash on their balance sheet. And then there would be this vulnerability to a potential financial transaction tax. Okay? Industrials obviously would be positively impacted by infrastructure spending. And municipal bonds would experience some form of dislocation as select states and municipalities may or may not receive federal aid. But here's the important point that is not being communicated effectively to everyone. And it's something that is on my mind and we all must think about. What is the sequence of implementation in terms of a blue wave? What comes first? What comes second? What comes third? Do you get an infrastructure spending bill first? And do you get higher tax consequences first? Or do you get tariffs being removed or lowered first? The sequence is going to be very critical. And I will offer a very strong argument in a blue wave scenario. The policymakers have to be very careful to listen to monetary policymakers and listen to the corporate and consumer environment about the economic conditions that currently exist. Immediately, sequentially coming out and raising taxes without also lowering tariffs, eliminating tariffs, or presenting an infrastructure bill could have a detrimental impact on the recovery, even for the uppercase of that K. So you need to be careful with that. In addition to that, the Senate in a blue wave, what would be the majority? The larger the majority, the more of ability they would have to introduce legislation that would be negative to the energy industry, a financial transaction tax. To get a financial transaction tax, Democrats would need a very strong majority in the Senate. So sequence and how much of a majority is held in the Senate is going to be very critical in the blue wave scenario. You've got all four of these scenarios. For all of you on the call, I am not going to, for one second, suggest which one I believe ultimately will be the one that we'll be navigating which. I think 2016 taught all of us, understand, plan for them, but don't act ahead of the outline, respect the potential outcomes, and be prepared for them. But I'll finish with where I started answering this question, Paul. The $90 trillion in global liquidity and the supply-demand investable asset imbalance will supersede for longer-term investors whatever the outcome is on this election.
Interesting. In a year of just some interesting results across the board. We can't get you to handicap it, play Wednesday afternoon a handicapper on this one. You're not gonna place a bet there on which outcome you like?
You know, if I run over to my coin jar and I pick a coin and flip it, I could give you an answer. But I don't think that's the right strategy for investors. I think they stay mindful and invested ahead of elections and be prepared on the other side to make, you know, the needed changes that they need to make.
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, all of our
I think you have to be careful. Let me just add this one point, Paul. I think everyone has to be really careful with this stuff, because I can't tell you how many people I heard suggesting after President Trump surprisingly won the election. And when I say surprisingly won the election, I'm not saying I doubted him. I'm saying just based on everything that was being communicated to us, right? We thought he had a very slim chance of winning. He won the presidency. And immediately everyone said, this is the moment for financial institutions. They will be the leading sector for the next 4 years because they're going to take the threshold on SIFI, the systemically important financial institutions, and they're going to lower it. And this is going to cause the yield curve to steepen. This is the moment for the financial sector over the next 4 years. How wrong was that? So you have to be very careful, very thoughtful in understanding the impact of these elections.
Understood. And at the end of the day, our investors, the people that trust us with their money, always they expect us to perform regardless of which scenario comes true. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind as we listen here. So, Joe, last question for me, then we'll open it up to the advisors listening on the line. But let's take it a little bit bigger picture. You know, we've heard so much talk about the death of the 60-40 portfolio for investors and where, you know, with interest rates being where they're at and the difficulty of repeating what a 60-40 portfolio has done. Can you just talk about more of your secular outlook? What's your longer-term return expectation for the markets?
So I think it's always proper to hold a very muted realized return expectation looking forward over the next 5 to 10 years. Always tell yourself that when it comes to the returns that you will enjoy, the future will not be brighter. Why do I say that? Because I think what that does is it creates behavior within yourself in which your behavior is similar to the behavior we've experienced in this crisis of preservation. You understand the importance of saving. You understand the importance of discretionary spending, and you really begin to think about that. So I think you properly adjust your behavior in that sense. You really outline what it is you want to be doing with your money in the next 5 to 10 years, being very specific. These are the goals and the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. These are the things that we're trying to do to create the happiness and enjoyment in the utilization of the capital that we're able to invest and see appreciate over time. So I think that's very important. But then I also think there's real solutions within the market. And I think those real solutions in the market really point towards seeking alpha generation opportunities And first and foremost, looking for those alpha generation opportunities as they present themselves in active management strategies relative to passive strategies. I think passive investors have had the benefit over the last 5 to 7 years of having corporations aggressively buy back their stock. And that's kind of acted as a hand underneath the market, Paul. So looking forward, and we're already seeing that buybacks are beginning to contract. In the previous quarter, they were down 55% year on year. That's the worst quarter they've had since 2012. So kind of taking that away, seeing where volatility is pricing itself. I mean, look at volatility today. The VIX, as we speak, closed at 28.65, with the S&P at 34.35. Now, back on February 19th, the S&P closed at 33.93, okay? So the S&P today is 42 handles higher than where it was at the previous all-time in February. But yet the VIX today prices at 28, and it was pricing at nearly half of that at a lower previous all-time high back in February. More volatile environment, less buybacks, active management, kind of providing that alpha generation opportunity. And then the other thing I would say is really understanding, and again, there's been a light that has been shined specifically upon the strength in the U.S. economy, and I talk about this often. There's a foundation that's built upon three things here for the U.S. economy. That's technology as the economy itself. The U.S. economy is an asset-light economy that exports its technology, does it better than anywhere else in the world. Because of that, we've got the secular blessing of energy independence. And then lastly, we have the strength of you and I, the consumer, because what technology is doing is it's taking pricing power and it's redistributing it from a goods producer to a goods consumer. So what do I want to do with that in an alpha generation opportunity? What I want to do about that, and I read an interesting article recently that I just want to kind of share with you, all of you, about this asset-heavy, asset-light type of economy that we're in right now, but really take a measurement of it in the S&P 500 and say to yourself, what is more valuable, the factory, the machinery, the office that a company that's an S&P 500 company might possess, or is it the algorithm or the software? And where is it that it is those intangibles, those asset-like assets, which are clearly the largest construct of the S&P right now, but they're somewhat invisible to a certain extent. The article that I read, which was so powerful, suggested that if you took all of the asset-heavy components, the automobiles, the planes, you took all the asset-heavy components within the S&P 500 and tried to sell them, what would they be worth relative to selling the algorithms that may be a Google or an Amazon or a software program that an Adobe or a Microsoft possesses? So the value of these intangible asset-light assets is so incredibly strong relative to the previous economy that existed that was bulk in its nature and asset-heavy. Well, how do you find alpha generation in that? What you do to seek alpha generation in that is you find first the sectors that are yet to be disrupted. So if I think to myself, clearly, healthcare is a sector that's yet to be disrupted by technology to create price transparency. If I think geographically, I begin to position myself looking around for alpha generation opportunities and say to myself, where is it exactly I can find a geographic asset opportunity that replicates the growth of technology and that asset-like construction within its economy? If I look at that, clearly the emerging markets most replicate what we're experiencing here in the United States in terms of transitioning towards an asset-light economy. So I think about that, and then I think in terms of equity size class. Where is it that the ultimate large cap and mega cap asset-light companies will be born? And they will be born in the ownership of small and mid caps. So I think about alpha generation opportunities. I think about the foundation of the economy and the impact of technology. And going back to your initial question, the U and the L are directly consequences of technology itself. But looking forward and understanding that technology is going to continue to provide for all of us on a call alpha generation opportunities, if you could just mine for that opportunity in a very tactical and active way, and you could do it both in the equity and debt markets. There will be high-yield solutions in the debt markets. There will be emerging market debt opportunities that will provide that alpha generation opportunity. So that's kind of how I think about it overall, just preparing yourself personally and your economic behavior, thinking about the environment as being a little bit more volatile, and then understanding where can we find alpha generation opportunities that have the catalyst behind it of the disruption of a movement towards a continued intangible asset-light based economy.
Good stuff, Joe. Thanks. I want to give a chance to open it up to questions if we can.
Best part of the call, please.
Absolutely. Operator, if we could open up the lines to any questions from the field, that would be terrific.
Certainly. Thank you. Our first question is from the line of Doug Bocock. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you, Joe. Do you have any comments on the Ken Anderson Rugnet team? We've used their funds for the past couple of years, and we're just interested if you had any comments on the Ken Anderson team. Thanks.
I think I have to deflect that question to Paul, if I could. My comments are specific to the capital markets and the economy. Paul, if you want to just quickly answer that.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to the way that we view Joe as a chief strategist, right? In terms of being able to be unbiased about the firms, all of the different affiliates and partner firms that we have in our lineup, such as Kane Anderson, Rudnick, and those. I think it gives him an added level of credibility to be able to talk freely about all of the asset classes and the capital markets that he sees and some of the opportunities. No doubt we think that the linkage to the sub-advisors and affiliated partners here at Virtus is a strong one and certainly has helped and is in line with Joe's thinking about the capital markets. But if you've got some specific questions, Doug, about Kane Anderson, we can certainly take that offline, and maybe somebody from our internal or external sales team could talk to you about just how Joe's comments and scenarios kind of line up with what the folks at Kane Anderson run, Nick, are thinking and the way they run portfolios, for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question, Doug.
Yeah, I'll ask you one other one if some others want to jump in on the conversation. But you talked about in the end there how you look at the emerging markets, and it sounds like you feel that might be an opportunity going forward. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the risks that we didn't talk about that you see out there, and maybe we didn't get a chance to talk about earlier?
Let me expand a little further on the emerging markets, if I could.
There's several ways to think about. Listen, clearly the consensus waiting from Wall Street heading into 2020 towards the emerging markets was underweight. There was very few that were carrying an equal weight or an overweight. Given what's occurred here in 2020, you have to move that consensus weighting to equal weight at best. A lot of it is because of the efforts of the Federal Reserve and their ability to remove which was a pre-existing condition and a secular condition of there being a global shortage of U.S. dollars. So any asset that was domiciled or priced in the United States but domiciled outside of it obviously was significantly challenged. And as I mentioned before, because of the economic excellence of the United States, any asset that was domiciled in the United States, investors kind of paid a premium for that. So U.S. dollar, we've halted the appreciation. I think it's down somewhere about 4% for the year. And the Federal Reserve has done a fantastic job just in removing the shortage the pre-existing condition of there being a shortage of U.S. dollars. In addition to that, I just look at the emerging markets themselves. I like that they are becoming more technologically asset-light oriented in their economy. I could think about them in equity size class where they don't have the predominance that we have here as it relates to large cap and mega cap. You could certainly seek small cap solutions, mid cap solutions in the emerging markets themselves. So that's where the evidence points me towards elevating my confidence and conviction towards allocations for the emerging markets, not just for the next 3 months, but, you know, looking forward over the next 3 to 5 years, clearly. Listen, risks in the marketplace. What's remarkable is that I made a comment on CNBC earlier in the year. I don't know if it was January or February. And what I was talking with my producers about this the other day, is I said that if the markets are lower this year, that it would not be directly attributable to COVID-19. Now, I could be wrong. That could, heaven forbid, there could be a massive second wave that could paralyze the country once again, and then the markets would go lower on that, okay? But my theory was that because I could tell that there was a pivot that had already occurred from the Federal Reserve. See, I think what's very important is that in the middle of 2019, monetary policymakers began to make this pivot. It's amazing how markets work, where it's almost as if markets were beginning to sniff out that there was this black swan that was going to come in the form of COVID-19 and this crisis of preservation. But I keep emphasizing, let's remember, we began to turn and pivot our policy towards a much easier monetary climate than what was previously existing in the first half of 2019 and clearly in the second half of 2018. Think about in January of 2019, in the early days where Federal Reserve Chairman Powell basically told everyone go buy stocks. He had that communication pivot because we were coming off that liquidity correction. 2 years ago today, we were in the midst of a liquidity correction because the Federal Reserve was taking away the liquidity. So, Paul, I really believe that the risks for the markets come in the form of policy mistakes. And when this crisis of preservation presented itself, there were many that compared it to the Great Depression. And really, I felt that that was a miscommunication because the only thing that was analogous between the Great Depression and what we experienced in March was the rate of the decline. It's 30-plus decline in less than 30 days. I think the decline we had from February 19th until March 23rd, that's the fastest decline in the shortest amount of trading days in modern economic times. But it felt similar to what you experienced in 1929. I want everyone on the call to remember something. 1929 and the Great Depression, it was not catalyzed by equity declines. It was catalyzed by policy mistakes. So Smoot-Hawley was the dominant trade policy at the time, contracting exports and imports with Europe over 65%, right? Republicans and Democrats were unified in terms of a very austere approach to fiscal policy, and the monetary-based liquidity contracted 7%. So monetary and fiscal policymakers made policy mistakes. And for me, that would be the single most the most concerning risk, is that we remove the nourishment for risk assets that is needed in what is still a deflationary environment because of the impact of technology.
Yeah, you got to keep in mind, right, that, you know, as a mixed economy, we're going to bounce between the invisible hand of capitalism and the very visible fist of government policies. I mean, good point in terms of some of the risks that are out there. So, operator, one last sweep of questions. Are there any in the queue right now for us?
Yes, we have one question in queue, and that is from Brent Rubnow. Please go ahead. Your line is open now.
Good afternoon, Brent.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Hi.
Hi, Brent.
I got on the call just slightly a little bit late, and I think, you know, where you were explaining one of the main thrusts of the whole call, which is the $90 trillion of global liquidity, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind just talking about that a little bit in a little bit more detail, and I'm sorry that it's probably repeating something that you said.
No, it's not repeating, but, you know, liquidity acts to nourish risk assets. And what I said previously was we talked a little bit about letters in the economic recovery, and I said really it's an alphabet recovery, and I gave a variety of different letters, V, U, L, K, and W. But if you think about the U and L, the U is inflation and the L is monetary policy, and they're connected. And it's so important to understand, and it really goes back to, and I'm thankful that the Federal Reserve recognized this. I had the opportunity on July 14th to do a two-hour fireside chat with Kevin Warsh, who was on the Federal Reserve during the Great Financial Crisis. And he really emphasized what I firmly believe is that deflation is the monetary condition that challenges us most domestically and globally. And the problem is what we keep doing is exporting deflationary pressures from region to region. So if you think about in 2016, remember, Chinese economic growth peaked in 2015. And the correction that we experienced in 2016 in the markets was that the Chinese tried to export deflation into the United States and the rest of the world. And that's what we're economically experiencing, is this musical chairs of deflation. There has to be a response to that. And the response to that comes in the form of liquidity. Now, the social consequence of that, I'm not going to argue with anyone on the call that would raise their hand and say, wait a second, I don't know that I like that. Because I'll tell you what, I don't know if I like it either, okay? Because it's rewarding, certainly, those that can participate, and those that can't participate are experiencing a continued recessionary environment since 2008. But it's important for this monetary policy to remain accommodative to offset the deflationary pressures of technology. And I think it's something that our policymakers in Washington, D.C. on the fiscal side are failing to address, both Republicans and Democrats. We keep trying to identify some form of a solution to why we've experienced multiple years of disappointing economic growth in the United States. What we really need to do is focus on the problem. And the problem is that, yes, Technology disrupts, benefits, gives you and I, the consumer, pricing power, but it also eliminates a tremendous amount of jobs. It also depresses income and the ability for those to earn, and it harrows out the employment opportunities within the country. So we have to address that problem. Thankfully, we have had policymakers that have been able to nourish risk assets throughout the duration of this deflationary experience by providing liquidity. And any time the Federal Reserve expands its balance sheet, you have to be invested. To go back and you look at December of 2012, we introduced QE3. We expand the balance sheet from $2.7 trillion in December 12th. Of 2012 until January of 2015, we reached $4.5 trillion as a top. What happens in 2013, 2014, and 2015? The S&P 500 is the leading asset class. So it supports risk assets. It nourishes them. And it's very critical that investors understand in that environment, you have to be invested. There's also a dramatic positive margin impact with lower private sector borrowing costs for corporations in that environment as well. So this $90 trillion of global liquidity, my comment was that that and the supply-demand imbalance for investable assets is going to supersede whatever the outcome of the election is.
Got it. Got it. So it's, yeah, that's great. Thank you.
Thanks, Brett.
Thank you. And I'm showing no further question at this time.
Great. Well, Joe, thanks again. As always, this was wonderful. You know, I just say to the advisors listening, it's always, you know, times like this, we got to remind ourselves that, you know, change is a constant force in our lives and the markets, all of the things that we do. And one of the great things about in this industry is that we've always proven to be extremely adaptable and even more hopeful. And while a lot of our traditional rhythms, our habits have been thrown off, right, getting together in person, doing these meetings in person, there's something undoubtedly lost in that. But we at Virtus, we look forward to helping you. We look forward to meeting the challenges that lie ahead with you all. And I just want to thank Joe, the listeners, everyone for their time, and hope that you continue to stay safe and stay healthy.
Thank you for the opportunity. And thank you for moderating today, Paul.